From Santa Ana.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Tim Valiquette, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here tonight. It's good to be sober. Good to see so many of your smiling faces. And I drove down tonight from Santa Ana. Traffic was light. It was great. And my home group is the Bellflower Big Book Group. And I go there every Monday and Thursday night. They have a meeting in Bellflower on Monday, and then sort of in Long Beach, I guess, on Thursday night under the bridge. The Monday night meeting starts at 7:30. If you're ever in Bellflower, please contact us. We'd love to have you there. We'll save you a seat. And if you're in the Long Beach, Belmont Shores area on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock, we have a great one-hour speaker meeting there. We focus just on the steps and the traditions. My sponsor's name is Gary, and Gary lives in Omaha, Nebraska. And you may wonder why I have my sponsor so far away. I'm going to tell you about that. And my sobriety date is August 9th, 1996. And it's the only sobriety date I've had so far. It took me 38 years of living to get here. You know, I tried to do it on my own as best I could, but finally broke down and came to Alcoholics Anonymous against my will. I thought that if I came here, you know, that was the end. You know, that meant that I was an ultimate loser, and I couldn't take it. There was one other person in my family that was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, my dad's sister, and she had been sober for a long time, 25 years at the time that I came in. And what I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous was about that much. It was all made up in my own head, you know, as is most things in life for me. I think I know the answer, and I think that, you know, if you ask me a question, even though I don't know, I'll pretend I know, and I'll make stuff up, you know. I grew up in a small city called Ottawa, Canada. That is kind of in the upstate New York, Vermont area. It's kind of cold there in the winter. So if you lived there, you'd probably drink too. I remember my childhood being pretty normal, I guess. My dad loved to drink. He used to drink rye whiskey. And on the back of those rye whiskey bottles, they had a little peel-off label that you could stick on stuff. And it had a maple leaf on it, and it said, "A Proud Canadian." And he used to put those maple leaf stickers, which were, you know, about yay big, all over our refrigerator. So we had the whole door covered with these maple leaf stickers from rye whiskey bottles. So I thought, you know, when I grow up, I want to be just like him. You know, I want to drink too. It looked like fun. We had a lot of parties at our house. They usually ended up in arguments and you know, fights and stuff like that. But that's just the way that, you know, I thought that's the way people drink. I also, like Scott, thank you for your 10 minutes. Also, like Scott, I was Irish, Scottish, but then I also had a little bit of French thrown in there as well. You know, just to top it off. So, you know, my people drank a lot. You know, that's what we did. And I was the oldest in my family. I had two brothers and a sister. We were all pretty close in age, about 5 years old. And I was always told to be, you know, the example and try and, you know, lead the way. I didn't do that very well. You know, I remember being a very nervous kid when I grew up, pretty shy. Usually, you know, blend into the, I'd probably be sitting along the back. You know, that's where I would typically sit when I came into a room. I wouldn't start off a conversation. I'd wait for you to start it off. And so I did a couple of things to compensate for that, because I hadn't discovered liquor yet, is that I sucked my thumb until I was about 12 years old. You know, that was my security blanket, I guess. The other thing I did was I kept a very low profile, but I love playing sports. You know, I played a lot of football, baseball, ice hockey. Those were my top three that I love. But I'd do anything. Because there, I didn't have to talk to anybody. You know, I could just do what I wanted to do. I could get out there and get all my aggression and anger out that I had pent up inside. And all my fears came out, too. So as I was growing up, you know, I learned that the way that you can get along and avoid trouble is to lie. I remember at a very young age, I think I was around 4 years old or something like that. There was these, you don't have them up here, but they're like windows that you put in your double-paned windows, and they're extra ones for the wintertime. Okay, so they're like an extra layer of insulation. They don't do them anymore because they've got good technology now with windows. They don't need them. Anyways, these windows were laying out on the grass. My dad was cleaning them, and I was 4 years old, and I thought, you know, because I wanted to be a hockey star, I thought that those windows were like ice. So I wanted to walk on them and pretend I was skating on them, you know. As soon as I walked on, they cracked and broke, obviously. And nobody was around. So I took off, did something else, came back. I heard my dad yelling, you know, for all the kids to come around. So at that time, there were only three of us, my brother and my sister. And my sister was only about 2 years old. I was about four. My brother was three. And he was trying to figure out who did it, you know, who broke this window. And he looked at each of us, and even at that age, I was a pretty good liar. And I said, I think it was my sister, Michelle. Yeah. And she got the spanking, and I got out of it, you know. So I got over that pretty quick. You know, I just said, whew. Missed it. And that's, you know, there were a number of incidents as I grew up like that, you know, where it was better to lie than it was to tell the truth. You know, I learned that I'd lie as even when the truth would suit me better, you know. An example of that happened in sobriety. But, you know, it's taken me a long time to start to realize that, you know, it's okay to be honest, you know, and that even in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, at my core, I'm still a liar, a cheat, and a thief, you know, and Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me to reduce that a little bit through the steps and trying to be of service to my fellow alcoholics, but you know, for most of us, it's a long process. It's a journey. We're never perfect. I started drinking when I was about 14 years old. I had tasted alcohol before that. You know, they gave it to me when I was sick. But I really started drinking when I, you know, mostly to be a part of the group that I hung out with. I was a pretty quiet, you know, polite, did well in school kid up until I went to high school. And then I discovered alcohol and drugs, and both happened pretty close together. At that time, this was in the early 70s, so there was a lot going on, and I loved going to concerts, you know, as a teenager. I loved drinking. When I started driving, I loved drinking and driving, you know, and as a result, I paid a price for that. You know, I remember getting pulled over and arrested, but even then, I was able to lie and con my way out of even talking to police about it, you know. And I remember one night in a snowstorm, it was icy out, got into an accident, had a 12-pack of beer on the seat beside me as I was driving along, hit the car in front of me, had a buddy in the seat next to me, and we said, we got to move quick to get rid of this beer. So we grabbed all the beer, and we waited until nobody was looking, and we stuck it in a snowbank. And then we just waited for the police to show up. and, you know, dodged another bullet on that one. So, you know, my whole drinking career was just filled with a lot of lies and manipulation along the way. When I was about 18, 19, I thought that, you know, if I keep going this way, because I was drinking at every opportunity I could get, I'm probably not going to make it to 21. So I thought that the solution to my problem was to find a girl and settle down. You know, so I asked this girl who I thought liked me whether she wanted to go out on a date. And she did. She said yes. And things went well for about 6 months. And then I thought, you know, we were getting close to finishing up high school. And I thought, you know, things are going so well that I think I'm going to ask her to marry me. You know, I was 19 years old at the time. And I don't know why I asked her to marry me. I think I wanted a steady date or something like that. And she, I remember the day I asked her, you know, it was April 1st, you know. And she said yes, you know. And we were both about the same age, crazy kids. She wasn't an alcoholic, even though I tried to help her to become one. So we started making plans, you know, for our future. And we wanted to go to college, you know, finish college, get a job, raise a family, all that sort of thing. Those were our dreams. We described, you know, where we wanted to live and how we wanted to try and buy a house on a farm and all this sort of thing, making plans and everything. And then we got a little bit ahead of ourselves, and I found out that she was pregnant. And this was, geez, after we'd been going out or engaged for about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. And so she told me this, and I thought, you know, all of a sudden I became a social worker and a counselor. And I thought that the best solution to her problem was to get it fixed, you know, go in to a hospital and have a procedure. You know, and so she did go into a hospital, but she talked to a real social worker instead of a make-believe social worker. And she decided that she wanted to keep that baby. So now I felt trapped. You know, I said, this isn't going according to my plan, you know. She decided she wanted to keep the baby. She was scared. I was scared. We decided, you know, my friends were all counseling me to take off and, you know, do my own thing, and I was seriously considering it. And but then, you know, I thought, well, what will her parents think? You know, what will she think of me? So what they thought of me mattered more to me than what I really wanted. I didn't really know what I wanted anyways. So we got married quite soon after. At the time, I'd been in the military. It was sort of pseudo military. It's called the Governor General's Foot Guards. They were a drill team that performed the training or the changing of the guard ceremony on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. So it's fashioned after the British changing of the guard that they do at Buckingham Palace. So I got to wear this like red scarlet tunic, a black bearskin hat. You know, I looked pretty awesome in the uniform. And we decided we were going to have a guard ceremony. So, you know, it was cheap. I wouldn't have to rent a tux then, you know. We could get married inexpensively. So we decided we're going to have a guard's wedding. And I remember the morning that I was to get married, I had to work. You know, we had to perform the ceremony of the changing of the guard. And we were just getting ready to final inspection at the base we were located at. Before we got on the bus to go to where we took off from our perform the ceremony, and the sergeant major, who is like the head guy, yells out my name, and I say, "Oh shit! You know what now?" I had to take 2 steps forward, stand at attention, and say, "Sergeant major," and he said, "Valiquette, there's a man up here in my office with a shotgun, and he's looking for you. So I felt like, that tall. We got married, and when it was just us, it was fine. But when the baby was born, it was like all of a sudden I had to grow up. And I was not ready to grow up. I was 20 years old and had a young son and a wife, and I was still going to college, you know. The only thing I really knew how to do was to party. You know, I would hang out with my friends more than I'd stay at home. I was into drugs at that time as well, so it was a double combination thing that was going on. And, you know, she was frustrated. You know, she didn't know how to stop me. 'Cause once I take a drink of alcohol, I can't stop drinking. You know, I keep on drinking. And if you add a little bit of drugs to that, you know, it gets even more interesting. I can't predict what's going to happen. You know, sometimes I'm going to take off in a car. Other times I'm going to get really angry and start throwing things. Other times I'm just going to be very quiet and fall asleep, pass out. You know, I couldn't predict my behavior. Things went so well with the first one that we decided to have another one, which was about 18 months later after the first one. And as soon as I heard the news that she was pregnant again, I went out and celebrated by purchasing a garbage bag full of homegrown marijuana. I thought, you know, given that I'm probably going to be home a lot, I need something that's going to kind of get me through the rough spots. So I proudly brought in my big garbage bag of pot and placed it on the kitchen table and said, "Look, honey, I bought in bulk. You know, it's going to help us to save some money." She wasn't impressed. She kind of rolled her eyes and said, "No, not going to work. What did I get myself into?" We had another son 2 years later. So by the time I was 24 years old, I was the proud papa of three boys. And I was still a kid, you know. I had decided that through college and, you know, what I was interested in, I wanted to study psychology because I wanted to help people, you know. And what I did as soon as I graduated is I did this part-time, and then I graduated. I became a social worker because I thought that, you know, I had something special to offer people. I've been through some tough times, and I knew, you know, how to help people. What really happened was that I needed more help than the clients that I was working with. You know, typically what would happen is I'd be drinking either the night before. And in order to take the edge off, I'd smoke a couple joints on the way to meet my client, you know, just to kind of mellow me out a little bit. And, you know, I was crazy. You know, I would skip appointments. I wouldn't show up. So what happened was I quit before I thought, and I would make up all sorts of excuses about them, you know, how the system is wrong. And so that's why I'm leaving. I went to work for my dad, actually, for a couple years, and that didn't go so well because he was deep into his disease at that time, too. So two practicing alcoholics wasn't a good mix for a business relationship. He was teaching me about how to be a management development consultant, and, you know, I'm grateful to him today because he did give me a foundation. But, you know, in terms of being a business together, it didn't go so good. I got some other jobs, and I was trying to stop drinking on my own after that point. I was about 28 years old, and I thought, you know, I can't go on this way. I was getting hassled at home. I was getting hassled at work. My kids wouldn't talk to me, and I thought, I need some help. So I started going to a psychologist and a social worker to get some counseling. And I went through all these different therapies, transactional analysis. For those of you that grew up in the 70s, you probably remember some of them. Transactional analysis, gestalt therapy, and something called bioenergetics. You know, so they were all popular in California at that time. And I was learning about them up in Canada through, for my work, but still drinking and using, you know, to do all this. What happened was that I made all these promises to my then wife how I was going to stop drinking. And she said that, I can't take it anymore. And what happened was that I went on this couples retreat with her. It was run by this priest. He was a Jesuit, I think, Capuchin. And he was very charismatic, you know, and loved to talk about God and Jesus, and, you know, they were all laying hands on each other and praise God this and praise God that. And it freaked me out because I had gone to church as a kid, a Catholic school up until about grade 4, and then I stopped. I went into the public system and I basically stopped going to church. And so meeting these people really kind of put me on edge. And I thought that, you know, if they're going to be kind of jumping around and being all happy and stuff like that, I'm just going to try and fake it till I make it and get out of here, you know. So during the weekend, they had this little exercise that they called a healing ceremony. And they asked people, you know, to kind of admit, it's kind of not quite like a four-step, but they ask people to admit, you know, what are some of the sins that you have, and then they're going to, you know, spray you with some water and some oil, and hopefully, you know, everything will go away. So they did that to me, and they laid their hands on me, and they sprinkled me with water and anointed me with oil, and, you know, for 3 months, I didn't feel like taking a drink or taking a drug. And that was new. I remember waking up the next morning and I felt, you know, lighter, how we do when, you know, we're closer to our higher power. And 3 months, that was pretty good. So that was from like August till about December. And then Christmas happened, you know, and you got to have a drink of wine at Christmas or else they might think that you're being rude or snotty or uppity or something like that. So I took the glass of wine, and slowly, over the next few days, weeks, I got back into my old habits again, except this time it'd gone underground, and I was drinking out in the garage. I was buying dope from my friends, smoking it out behind the garage, you know, just like I was in high school again or something. And my kids were out, you know, running around trying to look for their dad, and I was hiding behind the garage, you know. What happened was that after I had played this game for about 10 years, actually, after my initial spiritual, I call it a spiritual experience. After that initial spiritual experience, it was another 10 years before I actually reached what I call a bottom of some sort. I was to know other bottoms in sobriety as well, but this particular bottom was on our 18th wedding anniversary, and she said that, you know, she hadn't had enough time away from me. I was driving her crazy, apparently, and she needed to have a little bit of alone time. So she wanted to go visit her cousin, who was this massage therapist guy. She hadn't seen him in like 30 years. He was into native spirituality, you know. He had everything that I wanted to be, I guess. But so I was jealous, you know, that she was going to go away and spend 10 days at this guy's place. So I started making up all sorts of stories in my head about what was really going on there, you know. And I started to become a little bit of an amateur detective, you know, kind of going around the house looking for clues as to what's going on, reading emails, trying to figure out, you know, what's she up to type of thing. And what happened was that she came back from that vacation. I picked her up at the airport. It was a Saturday afternoon. I was a little drunk, you know. I'd had a few drinks. But I couldn't understand why she didn't want to give me a hug and a kiss after being away for 10 days. We went back home. The next morning, she woke up. turned to me and she said, "I don't love you." Just like that. I thought, the bitch. You know, how could she do that? You know, how can she treat me that way? She said that, you know, she realized that she made a mistake in marrying me on our wedding night, you know, because I had blacked out on our wedding night. That was a little embarrassing. But, you know, once you start drinking, I can't predict what's going to happen. She said that she didn't think it would last. And I said, well, I panicked. And I thought, well, let's try and, you know, go for some marriage counseling or something. Like, let's fix it. You know, I said, I'm not going to drink or use forever now. You know, I promise. But I did have a little bit of hash in my pocket, and I didn't tell her about that. But I did manage to, you know, finish that off without too much incident. But I was freaking out. I thought that she was going to leave me, and I would be nothing. I thought that, you know, the only alternative left for me was to kill myself, because I had known nothing about being with other women, you know, that I thought that she was the one, and I was going to be with her forever. So I was living in this fantasy world, this, you know, delusional thinking, and I wasn't connected with reality, basically. The only reality I knew was drinking, hanging around with people that drank like I did, and drinking like that myself. We went to the marriage counselor on her 18th wedding anniversary, and I thought that she was just a marriage counselor, but apparently I failed to notice that on her wall she was also an addictions counselor. So she told me that I should check out Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, well, I didn't think I was alcoholic. I thought maybe I had some codependency issues, you know, because I am, after all, a doctor, didn't you know? And so she said, you know, you might want to think about it. So I thought about it all that night. And the next morning I got up and I asked my then wife, who knew somebody who was in the program, another teacher. She had about 5 years, and I asked for her phone number, gave her a call, and I drove my bike over to her place, and I said, you know, can I come over and talk to you about Alcoholics Anonymous? And when I arrived there, she said, you know, Tim, you're in luck, because tonight at 8 o'clock there's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that we can go to. And I got scared. I said, I'm not ready to sign up or anything. I just want to talk about it, you know. She said, if you think you have a problem with drinking, then you probably do. And I thought about that all the time. Why can't I stop drinking? Why can't I drink like normal people, you know? Why do I always have to sneak drinks, you know, in the kitchen while other people are out in the living room drinking, you know? So I went to my first meeting, and she ended up being the speaker that night, Frances. And, you know, I said, this is great. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to 3 meetings in a row. And then I thought, that's enough, you know. I think I got this, you know. I get the idea. They do the same thing at every meeting, right? And so I kind of cut back on my meeting attendance to about once every 2 weeks. You know, I thought that would probably be enough for an alcoholic of my type. And what happened was I got crazier and crazier. You know, I ended up getting even more delusional, if that was possible. You know, because I would accuse my then soon-to-be ex-wife of, you know, all these crazy things about what she was doing, and she just had enough. And so what happened is that I got fired from a job after about 9 months of sobriety, as I call it. What happened was that at work I was a member of the leadership team there at this manufacturing plant in a small town up in Canada, right on the border. And I thought, I got a call one day, my phone rang, and it was a member of the press. Apparently the receptionist didn't know who to send this guy to, so she sent him to me. And He started asking all these questions about changes that were going on at the plant, changes in leadership and direction and strategy and all this sort of thing. And I thought it was my job to answer those questions, you know, because he asked me, instead of referring him to our communications guy at head office. And I was surprised the next morning when I woke up and read the newspaper, and it had a front page article about our company, and it was quoting me, inaccurately, by the way. So I was a little peeved about that. And I got called into, I got a phone call from head office, and they said, "What were you thinking? You know, it's not your job to answer questions." And about a couple of weeks later, I received a brown envelope saying that, yeah, we've had a reorganization, and you're the only one that's leaving. So I got fired. And so I thought that, you know, if I was going to, I was the first time I'd ever been fired. I went home, and she said, "I'm moving. I'm going to move to another city." It was about 6 hours away. "I've got a job there, and I'm going to, you know, start up. You can join me when you want to. So you stay behind and sell the house." And I was doing some contract work while this was going on. Sold the house, went to join her in that other city. She said, "You know, I've enjoyed this 6 weeks being apart, and I think I just want to live by myself with our son." Because our two older ones had moved out by that time. And she said that, you know, she didn't want to be married anymore. And she wanted a separation. And eventually we got divorced. So, you know, that whole time was the lowest part after about 18 months of not drinking but not really working a program. That was the lowest part of my life where I felt, you know, like dirt. I couldn't, I didn't have any idea what to do. By a miracle, I think, my car drove to a meeting that night, you know, when I heard that I wasn't going to be living with her anymore. And she, at the meeting, I heard, it was a discussion meeting, and I heard this woman talking about going through a divorce in sobriety, because I've heard it does happen in Alcoholics Anonymous, so. And she said that, you know, sometimes God prunes us of things that don't keep us sober. You know, and that hit home with me, you know, because I couldn't understand why I was feeling so awful and why she was doing this to me. You know, I wasn't taking any responsibility. So I started to work the steps with an old guy. He had about 25 years. His name was Big John. And he took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the fourth step, the fifth step. And he helped me to, you know, start on the path. Through that journey, I've lived, I got a job in the U.S. shortly after that in San Francisco. And that's where I really sort of caught on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous, because I found a sponsor there who really understood about service. And he nominated me as the coffee maker for that Friday night meeting. And that's what kept me coming back, because I had to open up the door to the meeting. I had to make the coffee. I had to hang out until the end of the meeting. It was terrible, you know. But I did it, and it kept me sober through that first 2 years. And I just to speed up a little bit, I got transferred to New York City. I was there during 9/11 when the Twin Towers went down, and I saw the second tower get hit. And thank God I had Alcoholics Anonymous there, you know, because the bars were full that day, you know, as I walked back home. But the rooms of AA were full that day, too. Soon after that, our company went out of business. I moved to Sioux City, Iowa, right in the middle of the country. For those of you that don't know where Sioux City is, It's just on the edge of the world. You can actually see the edge of the world from there. No, it's right. It's a beautiful part of the country. Corn, flat. But they have AA there, you know? And we got deeply into service there. Got into general service for the first time. And then about 7 years ago, or 10 years ago now, I got a job offer to move to Southern California and have been here ever since, going to Bellflower, Pacific Group, and Under the Bridge. And right now, I'm, by some miracle, I'm a grandfather as well. I've got four beautiful granddaughters. My oldest son, the one that I was counseling my wife on when I was 19 years old, is turning 36 tomorrow. He's living over in Denmark, working over there. He just graduated from the University of Oxford with a doctorate in music. And he amazes me. All my kids amaze me. My grandkids amaze me. It was not on my list to be a grandfather, you know. But it is, for those of you that are grandparents, you know what I'm talking about. For those of you that aren't, stay tuned. Hang in there. It's beautiful. And I feel so grateful and fortunate to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, to I have three guys that I sponsor, and I have some great meetings that I get to go to. And, my life isn't perfect. I wish it was, but I still have to deal with the same frustrations and struggles and personal, stuff going on at work. But at least I have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and those steps and a sponsor to get me through it. So thank you very much.